Hello, my name is Kylie De La Cruz, and I am a student project manager here at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I'm joined today by Dr. Marcia McNutt, geophysicist and president of the National Academy of Sciences. Dr. McNutt is visiting Dickinson College as the recipient of this year's Joseph Priestley Award for Outstanding Achievement and Contribution to Science. She will deliver the Priestley Award lecture titled Misinformation in the Age of AI tonight, and she's joining me for an interview this morning. Welcome, Dr. McNutt.
Thank you, Kylie. It's a pleasure to be here.
Starting off, what has been some of the most challenging but also rewarding aspects of leading the National Academy of Sciences?
Well, frankly, the most rewarding part of it is actually interacting with the members. The National Academy of Sciences has more than 2,000 members from all over the country and a large number of international members too. Each of them is distinguished in his or her own field, and I find it so much fun just to hear from them about their work and how it's really changing the world. The other part of being the head of the National Academy of Sciences, which is so rewarding, is the advisory work we do for the government and for other people around the country too, for states, for private foundations. Using evidence to help make better decisions is one of the most powerful uses of science. And I'm fond of saying that science is really the only approach that humans have ever found to peer into the future. And we are using science at the National Academy to help make decisions that will lead to that future that people want to see.
Does AI pose a threat to these decisions and the work done by the NAS? And if so, how?
So I'm afraid that the jury may still be out on what is going to be the trajectory of AI. We do have at the National Academies right now a trial effort to roll out an in-house version of AI so that we aren't necessarily revealing pre-decisional discussions out to the rest of the world. And we're finding that there are a number of uses of this AI, which is very, very beneficial. For example, I am constantly being asked to suggest groups of people to work on certain topics. Now, I'm a geophysicist, but the topic may be bioengineering, or it might be interplanetary discovery. What I love about AI is I'm able to ask it to provide me with a list of experts in these areas, and I can ask it to come up with experts who have geographic diversity and age diversity and other aspects like that, which will make for a stronger report. And it comes up with names of people that I've never heard of. But what I can do is I can go on the internet, I can check them out, I can look at their YouTube lectures and find out whether they are articulate and whether they know their stuff, and then suggest their names. But I wouldn't even know where to start without being able to call upon AI for that. On the other hand, I do worry about the fact that it has become too easy to fabricate scientific results with AI. And I am fearful that someday we might have a report in which we cite some relevant study which gave new information, which helped move the field forward, and then we find out too late that the entire project was fabricated. So there are pluses and minuses, and I think we just have to be careful, thoughtful consumers.
Are there some scientific fields that you notice have begun to use AI in their research, aside from using it to find scientific experts in the field?
Well, the most famous application of AI in a scientific field is in protein folding. And that was the subject of a Nobel Prize. And the use of AI to predict protein structures has been amazing. It has taken a process that, when it was left to humans to do it, would be very time consuming, very trial and error, and it has automated it to a point where our understanding of protein structures and how those structures relate to the protein functions has increased remarkably. I'm expecting to see similar things elsewhere in other fields where there's really a lot of complicated data and we don't quite have a firm basis for being able to predict from first principles, but it's been able to extract signal from noise in large data sets. For example, right now we're using AI for weather prediction, and it has actually been out-predicting the major meteorological models. And I expect we'll see the same thing in climate change predictions, that it's going to do a very good job by just ingesting lots of data from atmospheres, oceans, land use, fossil fuel emissions, everything, and come up with better models of climate change.
In your biography, you mentioned that you helped integrate the use of AI in deep sea exploration. Could you expand on the opportunities that you have had to work with AI?
So the application of AI in deep sea exploration was actually my first exposure to the power of AI. And prior to the use of AI in guiding untethered underwater vehicles, what scientists would have to do is they would have to anticipate everything ahead of time. They would program the vehicle to go do a search pattern in the ocean and use its sensors to map out anomalies in chemistry or biology or whatever of the ocean, and then bring the information back. And it would be hit and miss. Maybe the area we asked it to search was absolutely boring and nothing came back, or it might have something exciting. But once we integrated the AI, all we said to the vehicle was, go out in the ocean, drive around. When you find this signature, now map it out in three dimensions. Go, you know, one direction, once it starts tapering off, you turn around and come back. Once it starts tapering off, turn around, go back. So we could actually map in three dimensions something that prior to deploying the vehicle, we would not have even known it was there. And we program the vehicle to then, once it maps it all out, go to the center of it, where the signal is the largest, deploy your water samplers, sample the water for later laboratory verification, and then come home. And don't come home until you finish the mission. So the analogy I'd like to use is it's like having a really smart golden retriever going out searching for something, using its nose, and knowing when it finds it and brings it back to you.
That is amazing. What do you expect to see in the future of geosciences and geophysics in this integration of AI? Do you think we're going to be seeing more of it?
The applications of AI in geophysics are really staggering. First of all, geophysicists gather a lot of data. Each seismogram has an incredible quantity of information in it. And we aren't always able to completely analyze it all just with human intelligence. But using AI, I think we're going to extract a lot more information from seismic data. Another use of it has been with remote sensing. Geophysicists are now able to integrate sensors into drones and send those drones out, powered by AI, to look for features. Again, map them out just like we did under the ocean, and bring the data back when they're done. I'm seeing applications for detecting when forest fires first ignite. Using AI, pouring through satellite data, Earth imaging data, and also more ground-based instruments, and looking for that first little puff of smoke. Because after all, it's so much easier to prevent a major fire disaster if you can address that event right when it ignites and don't wait until it actually reaches populated areas. But the number of tools out there that are looking at the Earth from all aspects at all times are such that no one human could possibly filter through all of that data, but AI can do it.
Wow, I'm learning a lot right now. Oh my goodness. And kind of switching focus, as I was doing research for your event, this word infodemic kept on popping up. And I was wondering if you could explain what an infodemic is and if that is a word you would use to describe what is going on.
So infodemic is a term that I believe the World Health Organization invented. And it's because there are actually two types of misinformation. There's misinformation and there's disinformation. Misinformation, we see it very often in the health space because, frankly, no one really wants people to be sick. No one really wants people to die. But sometimes people get the wrong information and they pass it along, and it is actually contrary to the best scientific evidence. And so it causes problems because people believe it, but it's not as though someone's intentionally trying to cause harm. Disinformation is a case in which those purveying the information know it is wrong. And a good example is the tobacco companies that were opposed to any controls on selling cigarettes. Their own scientists had told them that tobacco was linked to lung cancer. But they did not want to lose their revenue, so they purposely pull out misinformation. So what the World Health Organization has done is they've combined misinformation with disinformation and call that an infodemic. And of course, pandemics are something that the World Health Organization spends a lot of time on, and they view this infodemic as a real problem in dealing with pandemics.
Yeah, and I think you've touched on this, but what are scientists' biggest fears, especially geophysicists, since you can speak to that, what are their biggest fears about the consequences of AI-driven misinformation or disinformation?
So I think the biggest concerns of scientists, regardless of field, is that it is going to cause people to ignore what is legitimate science and what is in their own best interests, best interests of society, best interests of the planet, by following the misinformation. For geoscientists, the biggest concern is climate change. Climate change, the data's clear, the scientific consensus is clear, but you can imagine how those who are interested in setting up disinformation, for example, fossil fuel companies or other groups like that, could actually use AI to convincingly counter some of the most important evidence for this current cycle of man-made climate change.
What are possible or proposed solutions to mitigate the spread of misinformation and also keep AI use in check? And then what also complicates these solutions?
I think what's complicated is that AI can be part of the solution as well as part of the problem. Generally, if someone queries something like ChatGPT and says, is climate change real? ChatGPT is unequivocal in its support for the scientific consensus. So I think that AI can be a place that people can turn to ask questions, and they will probably get legitimate answers because the creators of these big public large language models have done a pretty good job at not training the models on misinformation. However, on the flip side, bespoke applications of AI can be created to deceive. And I think the most important way to try to fight this misinformation is just by teaching people to be critical thinkers. For example, let me give you a good example. It used to be that when someone would say something to me that I was pretty sure was wrong, I'd say, have you checked that source? Have you taken a look at what might be ulterior motives for someone to distort the truth in that case? And then I realized that I myself, if I read something and I believed it, I didn't check it out. And so if these people are reading things and they're actually believing them, then they're probably not going to check it out. So my advice to everyone is double check everything you read. Make sure it comes from a reliable source. Make sure that there's some underpinning behind it. Make sure it agrees with lots of other sources, isn't just some outlier. Misinformation tends to be more salacious, more interesting, more worthy of sharing than information, because it's usually quite outrageous, but those shouldn't be reasons to share it. And then people also have to learn what are trusted sources. You know, I think we don't spend enough time teaching young people where to go for quality advice.
Absolutely. I saw that in 2024, the NAS released an editorial about scientific integrity in the age of AI. Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts on the proposed idea in the editorial of creating a strategic council on the responsible use of AI in science?
Well, first of all, I have to give my conflict of interest here because I was a co-author on that editorial. So, of course, I support the creation of this strategic council. And what the gist of this article is that as every scientist buys in to a certain code, we have certain norms of science that all scientists are expected to respect. And those norms include, for example, being transparent. How did you get to that answer? What data did you use? How did you process the data? How did you analyze it? The problem with AI, if you use AI in your research, you don't really know how AI came up with an answer that it gives you. And so we're very concerned about the norm of transparency in science being undermined by the use of AI. Another strong norm of science is attribution. If you have an idea that you came up with all by yourself, fine, but for the most part, we're inspired by reading other people's scientific papers or with conversations with them. And so attribution is an important norm of science. But when AI gives you the answer, it has amalgamated lots of information from the World Wide Web, and you aren't always sure where that specific part came from. So attribution is another problem. And then a third norm of science is reproducibility. You should be able to hand what you've done to someone else. They should be able to verify it by repeating your experiment. Well, as most people know, you can ask AI the exact same question twice and get slightly different answers. So what does reproducibility mean in the age of AI? So in this editorial, we conclude by recommending that there be a strategic council for the responsible use of AI, because AI is moving so quickly that what might be challenges today disappear tomorrow and are replaced by new challenges. So we figured having a standing group, which has on its membership those who are creating the newest AI models, those who are using the newest AI models, and those who are alert for potential violations of scientific integrity, can work together to make sure that our advice to the research community is always up to date and is consistent with how the latest models are performing.
What would you like those who are unable to attend the event to maybe know about what you're going to talk about, or even what the NAS stands for and what their role is in all of this?
I think the one takeaway for those who can't come to the whole lecture that I'd like them to keep in mind is the importance of being critical consumers. We just too often see something that conforms with our bias, and then we tend to embrace it. I think we all have to be acknowledging that as humans, we have bias. And when something conforms to a bias, that is especially when we need to check it. The one thing about the National Academy I'd like people to understand is that we are a nonpartisan group of scientists that does their best to use science for the benefit of the nation. to help people make decisions that improve their health, that improve their economic opportunities, that preserve our environment for our children and grandchildren. And the Academy doesn't have any specific policies that it promotes or that it tries to get other people to accept. All we do is when someone comes to us and they say something like, we would like to cure childhood poverty within the next 10 years. And here are the policies we're thinking of putting in place. Well, we can check those policies against the evidence, against evidence of the size of the problem, about human nature, about the source of childhood poverty. And we can help then say whether those proposed policies will actually lead to the outcome that's desired, and that is eradication of childhood poverty in 10 years.
Thank you so much, Dr.
You're welcome, Kiley.
This has been amazing.
All right. Thank you. Thank you for having me.